This is IBM, the Islamic Broadcasting Network. The following program is sponsored by the Islamic Media Foundation, sharing the guidance of Allah through broadcast media and the internet.
This is the best lecture series. Lessons and talks on various Islamic topics.
Today's program is Islamic Civilization, Myth or Reality, with Imam Zaid Shakir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Inshallah ta'ala, what I'd like to talk about Islamic civilization, because as we know, the very idea is being presented by many as something strange and alien and inconsistent with the nature of Islam, as many people wish to portray it, that Islam could be a civilizational force or a force for anything positive in the world, that Muslims are nothing but violent, prone barbarians, to speak euphemistically. So we like to discuss the idea of Islamic civilization. Is this a myth or a reality? And this is a subject even before the events which followed in the aftermath of September 11th brought this issue to the fore in some camps. It was an issue that's been discussed by many prominent Muslim thinkers in the recent epoch of this ummah, most prominently during the latter years of colonization of our land. This issue came up repeatedly, and probably the most frequent one to enter into discussion of the issue, and one most often quoted, the great Algerian thinker Malik bin Nabi, rahimahullah, and to our times, people such as Dr. Saeed Ramadan al-Bouti and others. So to start discussing anything in Islam, the tradition of our scholars is to define the thing being discussed. As we know, it's referred to as Mabadi' al-Ashr, 10 principles. The definition of something, its benefit, its virtuous relationship to other sciences, etc., etc. So we'll start by defining civilization. And naturally, such a broad, a frequently discussed term has many different definitions from many different angles or perspectives, and we'll limit ourselves to two this afternoon. One is from the Random House Dictionary. So in the Random House Dictionary, we read that civilization is an advanced state of human society in which a high level of culture, science, industry, and government has been achieved. So we can summarize this particular definition in two words: societal advancement. Random House is emphasizing this aspect of civilization, societal advancement. Second definition is from a slightly different perspective, and it's chosen for a number of reasons. This definition is provided by Samuel Huntington in his often quoted essay, The Clash of Civilizations. And we choose this at the beginning because we're going to return to this definition, inshallah ta'ala. So Huntington says in his Clash of Civilizations essay, which appeared in the early 1990s, that a civilization is thus the highest cultural grouping of people and the broadest level of cultural identity people have. So Huntington's definition emphasizes, if we were to summarize this in two words, cultural identity. So the first definition emphasizes societal advance, and the second emphasizes cultural identity. And we've chosen these two because we're going to use this as a yardstick to measure certain aspects of the Islamic social reality to see if indeed we can say that Islam produced a civilization. So, societal advancement, how can we look at this? We can look at this many ways. The way I choose to look at it is from the issue of science, both physical science or hard science and social science. So this is the yardstick that we'll use to measure societal advancement. Because if we say societal advancement, there has to be a yardstick to measure this if we're speaking in relative or comparative terms. Secondly, a unique cultural identity will measure this in terms of what's been variously referred to as high culture and low culture. And the two are very closely related. When these terms first came into use, high culture or low culture also being identified as mass culture. It was merely to not so much that each were talking about different things, but one was talking about a level of culture identified or associated with the aristocracy. This term came into use in European society, associated with the aristocracy and the intelligentsia in a particular society, and low culture associated with the masses. So if we look at Islamic history in light of these two groupings or these two categorizations, social advancement and a unique cultural identity, then I would say yes, indeed, Islam did produce a unique civilization. And so we'll look at that in detail. We'll start off with the aspect of cultural identity, beginning with high culture. There's an aspect of high culture that distinguishes it from low culture. They both talk about art, music, literature, architecture, etc. One level of art, literature, etc., being consistent with the taste of the aristocracy, the intelligentsia, one being consistent with the taste of the masses of people, the lower income groups in a society. But there's an aspect of high culture which is unique to the intelligentsia and the aristocracy, and that is that they adhere to and or initiate intellectual currents, philosophical schools, and they look at theology in a way different from the masses. And indeed, their ideas eventually become the ideas of the masses. So intellectual currents, philosophical schools, theology, theological schools, generally these are started by the aristocracy and the intelligentsia. And in time, they filter down to the masses. So this aspect of high culture is unique to a particular segment in society. So if we start from this point of departure, we can say that if we look at high culture, that Islam indeed produced a unique high culture. And unique being a critical aspect in terms of distinguishing Islamic civilization from other civilizations. So Islam produced unique intellectual schools which were unprecedented. And examples of these are the four juridical schools, which were the remnants of many, many juridical schools, that being the school of jurisprudence associated chronologically with Abu Hanifa, with Imam Malik bin Anas, with Imam al-Shafi'i, and with Imam Ahmed bin Hanbal. And there are many others, though, that passed away. So these four schools associated with the Imams, which we mentioned, are unique to Islamic civilization. No other civilization produced this particular manifestation. And the common link that unites these schools is also unique within Islam, and that being that they all accepted four basic principles, Al-Quran, or four basic sources, rather, as for the foundation of their legal systems. The Quran, the first and primary source, the Sunnah, the prophetic tradition, Al-Ijma', the consensus of the scholars, and Al-Qiyas. They agreed on all of these. These various schools differ on other sources. And schools that don't arrive to these four generally speaking, are outside of the tradition of Ahli Sunnah, although they wouldn't necessarily be outside of Islam. But these are the four principal sources that all four juridical schools agree on, and then they differ on others, such as Qawla Sahaba, the sayings of the Sahaba. Is that a source of legislation? Amal Ahl al-Madina. Some accept it, some don't. Most prominently, the school of Imam Malik. Istihsan, or juridical preference, being accepted by Imam Abu Hanifa, being rejected by Imam Shafi, in a sense. Urf, custom and convention. And other sources, they're called mukhtalif, mukhtalifun fi, differed in. Whereas the first four are accepted by all four schools. And they all have their proofs. Nowadays, many people, they have their proofs from Quran and Sunnah. So there's proof that ijma' is a valid source of legislation from Quran and Sunnah. There's proof that qiyas is a valid form of legislation from the Quran and Sunnah. So anyway, but qiyas is the most controversial nowadays of these four. So, but there's proof for that. Amongst the proof, the saying of Allah Ta'ala in the Quran, فَإِن تَنَازَعْتُمْ فِي شَيْءٍ فَرُدُّوهُ إِلَى اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. If you differ in something, refer back to Allah and His Messenger for a ruling. In other words, as explained in the relevant tafsir literature, if you don't understand the ruling of something, refer back to a ruling you know in the Quran and the Sunnah. فَرُدُّوهُ إِلَى اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. And then base your ruling on that analogy. So this is one of the proofs that the ulama use for the validity of qiyas. Another proof, Allah Ta'ala is saying, in Surah Yasin, قُلْ يُحْيِيهَ الَّذِي أَنْشَأَهَا أَوَّلَ مَرَّةً. Say, the one, he will revive them who created them the first time. So in other words, intellectually, if you can't comprehend how the resurrection will be, then reflect on how humanity was created in the first instance, and then on the basis of that analogy, draw a ruling concerning how Allah will resurrect humanity in the second instance. So, قُلْ يُحْيِيهَا الَّذِي أَنْشَأَهَا أَوَّلَ مَرَّةً. So understand how Allah created man from nothing in the first instance. And then make an analogy as to how Allah will create or recreate man in the second instance. So these are some of the proofs from the Quran, and there are many others. In terms of the Sunnah, one of the proofs the ulama used for the validity of qiyas. So what we're trying to say, when someone says we accept qiyas, we're not saying we're innovating in Islam. We're saying based on dalil, we not only accept the furu' or the derived rulings, jurisprudential rulings, but we also base the principles that we use to interpret and understand the sources and to extract the rulings, we base that on proof or evidence from the Quran or from the Sunnah. So one of the proofs for the validity of qiyas from the Sunnah is Sahih Hadith, when a man came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and he asked him, should he make Hajj for his deceased father? And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he said, what if he had a debt? Would you pay it for him? And by your paying it, would that debt be satisfied? The man said, yes. So the Prophet said, make Hajj for him, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So in other words, draw an analogy between your paying off the debt that he owes in his money to your fulfilling the debt that he owes in his ibadah. So this is one of the proofs that the ulama use from the Sunnah for the validity of qiyas. So the point being, Islam produced unique, distinct intellectual schools, and these four juridical schools being part of that. Islam produced a unique understanding of monotheism. And all of these are manifestations of high culture, philosophical schools, intellectual currents, etc. Islam produced a unique understanding of monotheism. So for example, the Christians have a monotheistic belief. So when people talk about monotheistic faith, they don't usually categorize Christians with pagans. They say the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews. But their idea of monotheism is adulterated because they say, yes, God is one, but he's also three. So their idea of the oneness of God is adulterated by the idea of the Trinity. He's one in three, he's three in one. So they have an idea of monotheism, but clearly the Islamic idea is different from that and unique and distinct as compared to that. We say, no, he's not one in three, he's one, period. So it's distinct. The Jews, Judaism has a more unadulterated form of monotheism vis-a-vis Christianity. So the Jews don't say Allah or God is one in three and three in one. They say he's one, period. But in their scriptures, many anthropomorphic qualities are attributed to God. So we read in Genesis, for example, that God hid himself in the garden. Or he couldn't find Adam, hid from God. And God's asking, yeah, Adam, where are you? Or God was walking around in the garden. So these sort of qualities that are applicable to human beings, people hide from us. But human beings don't hide from God. And we take strolls out in the beach here and along the beach. But God doesn't stroll in the garden. So the idea of monotheism with the Jews is adulterated by anthropomorphism. And this is a huge issue in Judaism. And if you study the Judaic scriptures, you see many, many, many things that Muslims would say or deem unacceptable. So Muslims, we say, لَمْ يَلِدْ وَلَمْ يُولَدْ وَلَمْ يَقُلْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدْ. That Allah didn't give birth to anyone, he wasn't birthed. And there is nothing comparable unto him. He is alone. He is one. So our view of monotheism is distinct vis-a-vis the Jews, the Christians, and other faiths. So this is a unique contribution that Islam brought. So again, this is a unique manifestation of the civilizational genus that Islam brought about, or genius. Thirdly, Islam produced unique philosophical schools, which provided the basis for an orthodox system of speculative theology, which made it possible for Muslims, in a systematic way, to defeat the attacks upon our creed by the forces or advocates of alien creeds. These schools are usually identified as two, the school of the Asha'ira, and the school of the Maturidiya. Now, by saying this, I'm not saying personally, and I agree with the scholars who say this, that it's not necessary for everyone to understand the details of these schools, that you don't have to spend 5 years learning the intricacies of Ilmul Kalam, but that when Muslims decided that they had to defend themselves against the attacks of the Mu'tazila, against the Ismailiyya eventually, and their secret societies that were set up to destroy Islam, against the Zanadiqa, the adherents of other faiths who posed as Muslims and entered into Islam and began to spread ideas alien to the Islamic creed. So when Muslims decided we have to fight these people intellectually, the intellectual weapons that they used, the philosophical tools that they used, were the tools provided by the schools of the Asha'ira and the schools of the Maturidiya. And on the basis of that, they defeated these threats. And because they defeated these threats, nowadays Sunni Muslims have the luxury, as they believe, of saying that these schools are bid'ah and innovation and we don't need them, they're bad, they've destroyed our aqidah, etc. That's a luxury that we have because these schools existed and because on the basis of these schools, the scholars of Ahli Sunnah wal Jama'ah were able to defeat these threats that could well have destroyed Islam. So the ulama say, yes, they were bid'ah, they were innovation, but it was bid'ah wajibah. For the ulama, such as Imam Nawawi and Imam Izz bin Abd al-Salam, who say the bid'ah is ranked like in Aqidah is ranked like the, or the rulings in Aqidah are ranked as the rulings in Sharia. The ranks of the wajib, mustahab, mubah, makruh, haram. That some bid'ah are wajib. And they said this was a bid'ah that was wajib, that was obligatory, wajibah. And some bid'ah are highly desirable, some innovations. And some bid'ah are permissible. And some are highly disliked, and some are absolutely forbidden. So the same ranking that pertains in the Sharia, in the eyes of many ulama, it pertains also in Aqidah. Wajib, or absolutely incumbent, or obligatory. Mustahab, or highly desirable. Mubah, or permissible. Makruh, highly disliked, or undesirable. And haram, or forbidden. So this basic ranking, or the rulings in Sharia, also pertains in the view of many ulama in Aqidah, and one of these wajib innovations in the view of many of our scholars was the speculative theological schools of the Ash'ira and the Maturidiya. And it's a big issue that we shouldn't try to gloss over in a superficial way. So this is in terms of high culture. In terms of low culture, poetry, art, music, etc., again, the Muslims made tremendous, unique contribution. In poetry, it was the Muslims who discovered these 15-metered rhyme schemes that underlay the Jahili poetry. So it was Khalil bin Ahmed al-Farahidi who first extracted by studying the language of the Arabs. Why? Because they wanted to understand the Quran and realized to understand the Quran, we have to understand the language of the Arabs. So they looked at the Jahili poetry because it's one of the purest expressions of the Arabic language. And they sought to understand the intricacies of it. And by studying it, they discovered there are 15 distinct patterns that Arabic poetry is based on. And then on the basis of that, they proceeded to write their own Islamic poetry. And the Muslim poets began to undertake their endeavor and to systematically study the poetry of those who came before them. The same pertains to music. Muslims sung. Again, nowadays people might be afraid to sing. But when the Prophet came to Medina, what did the Sahaba do? They sang him a song, right? They sang him a song. In Kitab al-Nikah, Sahih Bukhari, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that the Ansar love to sing, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So, and the poetry of the Muslims, these are songs. So similarly, manifestation of culture, food. Muslims have our own unique food. Not unique from the various areas and regions where we hail from. So Malaysian food is distinct from Bengali food, which is distinct, I guess, depending on how hot one or the other is, from Indian food, which is distinct from Pakistani food, which is distinct from Arab food, which is distinct from African food. But Islam gave all of these foods certain common elements in that there's no pork in it, there's no alcohol in it, there's no blood in it, etc. So this is a distinct cultural manifestation that Islam brought about. Similarly in clothing, as we all know, that Islamic clothing in Malaysia is distinct from Islamic clothing in the Indo-Pakistani subcontinent, as distinct from the clothing of the Arabs, as distinct from the clothing of the Africans, etc. But all of the clothing that Islam brought is loose and covers the form of the body. So Islam affected and shaped the clothing of the Muslims in very unique and distinct ways. And this brings another point. And we mentioned this diversity, and this is a manifestation of Islamic civilization in terms of civilizations producing people certain attitudes towards fellow human beings. Islamic civilization is very assimilative. It doesn't try to get all Muslims to wear Levi's. Some civilizations do. Everyone has to wear Levi's because it makes marketing that much easier for the companies that make Levi's. You have to wear Levi's. So anyway, this tolerant, assimilative characteristic of Islamic civilization is indeed just that. It's a characteristic of our civilization. And it's unique. And one reason it's unique, and this brings, and we're just touching on this, another aspect of Islamic civilization, is that our civilization is based on faith. And it's not based on a particular geographical location. If you look at all the old world civilizations, Greece or Rome or Egypt or Kush or Sumeria or India, China, Japan, they're all specific to a specific geographical location. Japanese, the islands off the coast of Eastern Asia, or Indian civilization in the valleys of the Indus and Ganges rivers. Egypt and the Nile Valley civilizations, they're associated with the Nile Valley. And therefore, as these civilizations expanded, the uniqueness of that geographical location was used as a standard which was imposed on everybody. But our civilization is faith-based. So it's not based on a particular geographical location. It's based on a particular faith that believers share, which is based on a corpus of knowledge which was given to the world by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this aspect doesn't make it necessary, or Muslims never felt it was necessary to impose the standards of dress or food or other aspect of culture that were unique to a specific geographical location on people in other locations. So this is another unique aspect of our Islamic civilization. Art, our emphasis on arabesque or abstract geographical or geometrical forms, using calligraphy, using the word, beautifying the word, and beautifying with the word. So their faith and their attachment to the word was used to beautify. And we see this throughout the tiles, manuscripts, etc., all beautified by the word. So calligraphy being an art form that Muslims took to its highest expression. Other societies have calligraphy. But how does, for example, calligraphy in the English language, England, America, Britain, compare with calligraphy based on the Arabic script, the Latin script to Arabic script calligraphy? There's no basis for comparison. And you see the different forms the Muslim, the Kufic, Diwani, etc. And you see the beauty of it. There's no comparison in what Muslims did with it. And the greatest example of that is in Spain, Islamic Spain. When you look at the masjid surrounding the cathedral in Cordoba, and you see this beautiful masjid, and you stand back and you look down, and it's like one single column instead of hundreds, one opening up like palm leaves opening up as you look down, and then at the end of your gaze is this gross cathedral that even the prince who commissioned it, he said, "You've done us a disservice. We wanted you to show up the Muslims. You've shown us up." So there's no comparison between the two. Compare the anything. You can't compare anything to the Taj Mahal. There's nothing to compare. You see this beautiful, stately, timeless edifice and the minarets and the proportions, and that non-Muslims say is the most perfect building on earth. They describe as one of the wonders of the world. So this is what we produced as Muslims. And we see this all over. But, and this will stop here and move on to the next element. So these are elements of high and low culture, that Islam produced something unique, distinct, that gave us a distinct identity. And many of us are trying to reaffirm that identity. And so you see very few Levi's at Deen Intensives. Reaffirmation of our unique and distinct identity. The first element that we're dealing with, secondly, based on the first definition, the idea of societal advancement. So in this area also, Muslims and Islam made a very unique and distinct contribution. Some critics say, no, the Muslims did not have a unique and distinct contribution in this area, nor in the first. And we look at, and we say, scientific, physical, and social science as the standard to measure this advancement, that the Muslims merely borrowed from earlier civilizations and then passed on those earlier civilizations to the Europeans. And this is not accurate. It's accurate, yes, in terms that Muslims did borrow to greater or lesser extents from earlier civilizations, indeed, particularly the Greek and Hindu, to the west and to the east. But every civilization borrows from earlier civilizations. As humans, we exist an organic relationship to each other. There's no such thing as a society that appears in a vacuum. It's poof, we have Greece. The Greeks borrowed from earlier civilizations, and this is documented. The Greeks borrowed significantly from the Phoenicians, from the Babylonians, from the Sumerians, from others, and more specifically from the Egyptians. Many of the things that characterize Greek civilization were borrowed from the Egyptians. And it's significant to note that Pythagoras, Democritus, Plato, and many other leading Greek philosophers and or scientists and or mathematicians spent significant portions of their life in Egypt and study the civilization of the Egyptians. Now, this isn't to say that the Greeks did not add to that, or the Greeks did not give a unique redefinition to all of that. They did, but they did borrow from those earlier civilizations. And similarly, the Muslims borrowed, and the Muslims also gave a unique Islamic contribution and flair or touch to everything that we became involved with. So to move on from here, if you look at various areas of science, you can see the contribution of the Muslims, even to this day. If we start with chemistry and pharmacy, just by looking at some of the terminology that we use contemporarily, which still bears the Arabic names, we can get an idea of that contribution. For example, we'll make examples. Borax. All of us have heard of borax. This is from the Arabic word boraq, elixir. That's from the Arabic word al-iksir, gas. It's from the Arabic word al-ghaz, savon. It's from the Arabic word sabun. Alcohol. It's from the Arabic word al-kahul. Talcum. It's from the Arabic word al-talq. And in a pharmaceutical use, of not as a dye, saffron is from the Arabic word zafaran. So, and you can go on like this. These are just a few examples to show the influence of the Muslims in this particular area and the advancement that they made, so much so that the names of these things still bear their Arabic antecedent. If we look at the area of medicine, and this is a huge area, just to make a couple points. Ibn Sina, who is one of the greatest Arabic practitioners of medicine, but probably not the greatest, maybe the greatest was al-Baghdadi. Anyway, Ibn Sina wrote a book called Al-Qanun, dealing with various aspects of general medical practice and surgery. This book was the standard text at all major European universities until the middle of the 17th century. Ibn Sina died in 1037. So we're talking a book being used hundreds of years, even in Europe. And it was used as late as in parts of Italy, Al-Qanun, and its translation was used as late as 1910. So for over 800 years, this book was being used. So this gives you an indication of the level that the Muslim physicians had attained to in this regard. Ibn Nafis of Damascus, Ibn Nafis discovered the circulatory system, and he charted it out in great detail that modern medicine has very little to improve on what Ibn Nafis discovered and charted. And again, this was hundreds of years before similar or comparable discoveries in Europe took place. So this is an indication of the level that the Muslims had attained to. And this medicine was practiced and applied in free hospitals, which is another aspect of our civilization. We'll talk about this later in terms of social institutions. In mathematics, there are many giants, but the greatest of them all, Al-Khwarizmi, a great scholar and a great mathematician. And many of these people, they were scholars. They were ulama, some of them were philosophers. They were versed in the Islamic sciences, and they were actual physical scientists. Al-Khwarizmi, there's an argument, some Hindus are saying Al-Khwarizmi did not invent the zero. So you can debate this. But what's not debatable is that Al-Khwarizmi was the first to use the zero, or the concept of zero, in mathematical formulations and calculations, and this revolutionized mathematics. Al-Khwarizmi invented algebra, which still goes, in Arabic, algebra is called Al-Jabr. So it still is known by its Arabic name, algebra, al-jabr. He also invented the logarithm, an aspect of algebra. So, and we know this science is still taught and studied today. His book, At-Takamul wa Tafadul, was the standard text in the area of algebra until the 16th century in Europe. It's translated into Italian amongst other languages. Al-Khwarizmi died in 847. So this book was the standard text in parts of Europe until the 16th century. So again, we're talking over 700 years, rahimahullah. In terms of astronomy, the greatest Muslim astronomer, there are many, many, probably the greatest, Al-Bittani, who died in 317 of the Hijra calendar. So he was a very early figure. He charted the movement of the stars and planets with precision, to a level of precision that is still basically used and utilized to this very day. And again, indication of that, many Arabic terms are still azimuth, terms of the movements of the stars, asempt from Arabic, and nadir, and nadir from the Arabic. He was able to predict and the timing of solar and lunar eclipses into the distant future based on the studies of the stars, the planets, the sun, the moon, the earth, and the relationship between all of that and the earth. And as you've heard Sheikh Hamza say, 43 of the 50 major navigational stars that we use today still bear their Arabic names. And to just mention a few examples of them, Al-Qamar, Akhir al-Nahr, the Arabic. Al-Khabar, Al-Khabur, the Arabic name. Al-Danab, Al-Danab. Danabola, Zambul-Ula, the Arabic original. Markab, Al-Markab. Rasalki, Rasul-Jaw. So, and there are 43 of these stars that still bear their Arabic names in an anglicized form. So this is an indication, and of course we forgot Betelgeuse, Iptaljosa. So this is physical science. In terms of social science, we can start with the great Ibn Khaldun, who is not the first. Many of the things Ibn Khaldun talked about, Imam Mawardi before him talked about these things, and others, but Ibn Khaldun in his Muqaddimah, he put many of these ideas to writings in terms of social science, and as a result, he's attributed with being the first to introduce a philosophy of history. There are many historians before Ibn Khaldun, but he was the first in the modern sense of the word to come up with a philosophy of history in his Muqaddimah. And he's attributed before Durkheim with being the father of modern sociology. So hundreds of years before Durkheim and Max Weber and others in the West. Many of the things they were saying, he said before them. And he based it on very precise social scientific laws that he deduced from a detailed and intricate study of human societies. In the area of psychology, Imam Ghazali, many of his writings, he's looking at the motivations for human behavior. And on the basis of that, how can we successfully reform character defects? And this became a major part of the science of tasawwuf. to understand the motivations for human behavior, and on the basis of that understanding, modify human behavior for the better, so that we can produce a person that's a reflection of the refined and perfect human being. No system of social science is any better than the social institutions that it gives birth to. And the system that we had gave birth to very lofty and solid social institutions. And we mentioned two of them, the Awqaf, the system of perpetual endowments, which provided for a number of social functions being met. Most prominently, education. Most of the major Islamic universities began as endowments by wealthy Muslims. And today, most major private Western institutions, Yale, Harvard, Cornell, Penn, all of them are based on endowments, multi-billion dollar endowments. That's how they run. And most of their expenditures are taken care of based on the interest of their investments. And to make this point, we make a second point, and that is the role of Muslim women, the point of endowment. How do we tie this in? The Qarawiyyin, some of you went to a few years back for your Deen intensive. Qarawiyyin was built based on an endowment from a woman, Fatima al-Fihriya. And her sister built another school across town in Masjid al-Andalus, Aisha al-Fihriya. So you can see that women were out there and playing a part in our societies. Another institution, the endowment, the classic case study of endowments is Damascus. Not today. You go there and where are the Awqaf? They've been stolen and put into one building, Wazarat al-Awqaf. But at one time, Damascus, there was an endowment for infirm animals. Someone has set aside land. Now it's the National Fair and Exhibition Ground next to Jisr Rais. You see this long strip where they have all the trade shows and everywhere. This is where that was. So someone has set aside this land when your horse got too old to work, or the old gray mare wasn't what she used to be, brought her over there, and she lived out her days in peace. She ate and grazed, and someone was there to wash her down. And all of this was paid for by an endowment. They had the endowment for broken pottery, another famous Damascus waqf. So the little boy is going to get the family's water and trips and breaks the water jug, and he's afraid to go home. He goes to the waqf for broken pottery. They look at it. If they have one similar, they give it to him. If they don't, they make one. And then he lives happily ever after. You broke the water jug. Oh, a brand new water jug. Very good. Ahmed. Mabruk. Not Mabruk, Mubarak. Mabruk is a common Arabic error. Because if you say Barak al-Jamal, the camel parked himself. So when you say Mabruk to people, you're saying, may you be like a parked camel. So that's from Mubarak. People say Mubarak. Don't say Mabruk. Say Mubarak. Don't say Mabruk. بارك الله لك وبارك عليك وجمع بينكما في الخير. Don't use this as if Imam Zayd said, بارك الله, we should all get married. So you see brothers and sisters strolling on the beach tonight. I'm just trying to find the right person, brother. So once you get married, then you say, بارك الله عليك, بارك الله, مبارك, don't say مبروك. So, but we had this one of our Damascus jokes, when certain political figures were celebrating great victories, even if they were imaginary. Mabruk! You say, nah, Mabruk! Let's be nice. Okay, moving right along. Another great social institution we had was the institution of the Hisbah. The Hisbah being the Office of Poor Public Duties. And the Muhasib had people responsible for regulating the marketplaces, construction, to see that construction, no one was oppressed, no one built the house where the windows looking down into the courtyard of his neighbor, or the upstairs portion is blocking traffic in the street below. People might hit their heads on the overhang, or the tunnel between two sides of the house is so low, people might, traffic might be obstructed, so build it higher, etc. Regulating the prices, make sure prices were marked, there were price tags on commodities. No one was selling rotten or otherwise defective produce in the marketplace, etc. So you had people doing these things, and you had higher functions. Imam Subki has a book called Mu'id and Ni'am, Mu'id and Niqam, the things that regenerate blessings and that drive away things that are the sources or cause for remorse. And in this book, he mentions over 100 duties, public duties for officials in the Islamic realm. And he gives advice for them. And amongst the duties he identifies is, for example, the guardian of the animals. Someone make sure that no animals were being abused. So we had a version of the Humane Society in Islam hundreds of years before it existed in the West. Another, an example he gives in terms of the guardians of the animals, he said that the people that stucco the walls, before they apply the stucco, they had to investigate to make sure there were no bird nests or there were no animals that had built their homes in the wall, because if the walls were stuccoed over and the animals were trapped inside and died, then the state would be accountable before Allah Ta'ala. So we had a very lofty and refined system of public duties. Similar, the guardians of the plant and trees, a person whose duties were to make sure all the plants were watered and that trees weren't being cut down unnecessarily, etc. So again, we had an environmental protection agency hundreds of years before the EPA existed. And there are many, many, many others. These are just by way of example. In conclusion, the obvious question that one would ask, especially if one were non-Muslim listening to all this, where did it all go? What happened to you guys? And the answer would be that basically we lost touch with our institutions. And as a result, this civilization went into remission. But as is proven in the past, because our civilization is faith-based, whenever the faith grows in the hearts of the believers, we can regenerate this. And this is why, unlike any other civilization, which was land-based or water-based or geographically based, based on geography, you don't see regeneration. But you see Islamic civilization going through an Arab phase. And then when that wanes, it regenerates in a Turkic phase. In various epochs, the Seljuk, Ottoman, you see it regenerating itself when that wanes in several African manifestations, in Mali and in other areas, in Spain, Islamic Spain. So you see the regeneration of Islamic civilization. And it can happen in this country. If we give ourselves to Allah and we strengthen our faith. But generally speaking, in the wider sense, it has declined, and declined greatly. And some of the reasons for that, one is the weakening of the faith, for various reasons. One is being faith-based, and faith based on knowledge. You have to know something before you can believe in it. فَعْلَمْ أَنَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ. So a lot of our knowledge was lost. The most significant loss during the sacking of Baghdad at the hands of the Mongol. And they say that so many books were thrown into the Tigris and Euphrates River, the river ran black with the ink washing off the pages of the books. And if you look at some of the compilations where the writings of the Muslims are mentioned, such as Kashf al-Dhunun, 5 volumes of what the Muslims have written, you'll see that many of these books that are mentioned, they didn't reach us. That this Imam wrote so many books, and only a percentage of that reached us. So a lot of knowledge was lost. Certainly the essential knowledge reached us, but there are a lot of things that were lost. A lot of it was stolen during various epochs, during the Crusade. A lot of our knowledge, a lot of our literature was stolen. And primarily during the era of European colonization in the modern era, which was the most damaging foreign force, which led to the loss or the demise or decline, severe decline of this civilization. European colonization was unique in one specific way. The Crusaders came and destroyed and occupied and ransacked and pillaged and stole. The Mongols came and did the same. But the Mongols were eventually absorbed into Islam. You know, the hordes that reached Russia, this became the Golden Horde. They accepted Islam. So when Peter the Great rallied the Russians and pushed back the Mongol hordes, the leader of the hordes at that time, and this became, as we said, the Golden Horde, was Ahmed Khan. Ahmed Khan, and not Genghis. They came as Genghis Khan and went back as Ahmed Khan. So Islam absorbed this. Islam expelled the Crusaders. And it expelled the Crusaders because Muslims were proud. Salah ad-Din and Nur ad-Din Zenki before it, these were proud warriors. And these people felt violated and they wanted Islam back. European colonization, perhaps for the first time, produced, because it was so thorough, produced in Muslims an inferiority complex. And for the first time, Muslims wanted, we talked about the Levites, to dress like the non-Muslims. The beards for the first time were shaved off to look like the non-Muslims. Huda Sha'rawi, off with the hijab, to imitate the ways of the non-Muslim. And Ibn Khaldun talked about this. The conquered imitating the ways of the conqueror. So you had insecurity, inferiority complex, coupled with the destruction, wholesale destruction of our institutions. If we mention the great Islamic institutions of learning that went into the colonial epoch, such as Qarawin, such as Zaytuna in Tunis, or Al-Azhar, or Mustansiriya in Baghdad, or many others, how many survived? Only Al-Azhar survived. And recently Qarawin being revived as a functional institution of higher Islamic learning. So this was devastating. Muslims generally had a very high rate of literacy. And why was this? The Katatib, the little Quran schools that existed from one end of the Ummah to the other. And going into colonization, if nothing else, every Muslim generally could read and write the Quran, or a very high percentage, and especially the males. After colonization, these schools generally only survived in the mountains and remote places of the western part of the Ummah, and Maghrib, in the Atlas Mountains, and Chad out in the desert, and Mauritania out in the desert, the Spanish Western Sahara. Other than that, they were destroyed. And so only those people who were privileged to go to the Western schools set up by the colonizers became literate. And they weren't teaching them Arabic. We know in Algeria, once the French vanquished the Algerians after the defeat of Amir Abdul Qadir and his exile, soon thereafter, they made it forbidden to teach Arabic. And the effects of that are still obvious in Algeria and Morocco. You can see the effects of that in terms of the level of Arabic amongst the people and the nature of their dialect, something very far removed from the Arabic language. So this created an unprecedented situation. And our civilization built around this whole scheme of knowledge, institutions, etc., became severely weakened. Some of these, or the inferiority complex, led to the demise, by and large, of our intellectual institutions. Not meaning schools, but the school of speculative theology. When Muslims looked at the Europeans and saw what they perceived to be a stronger society militarily and became very insecure, they began to discard things and began to listen to arguments that the enemies of Islam were making. So they were saying, for example, you had a movement to return to the Quran and Sunnah. We have to get rid of the schools of speculative theology, because these destroy the spirit of inquisitiveness. We have to get rid of the four juridical schools, because this leads to formalism and a stultifying stagnation in terms of our creative legal thought. We have to get rid of tasawwuf, because these Sufis have made us fatalistic. We're just waiting to die for pie in the sky and the by and by. And we no longer have the desire to engage the world. We're just happy to sit up all day and make dhikr until we die. And there were Muslims that said, yes, that's true. So, and by saying that, we threw out the baby with the bathwater. Certainly there were areas that needed reform. By rejecting the system of speculative theology, so these Ash'aris and Maturidis, this all bid'ah, get rid of it, return to the pure Aqidah of the Quran and Sunnah, we lost a system to effectively engage in meaningful philosophical and theological discourse. As a result, we see an ethical vacuum in our societies. Go to a library and see what Muslim voice is making a significant contribution to any of the major philosophical and theological and ethical debates of the day. You find nothing. Similarly, we've rejected the juridical schools, generally speaking, as bid'ah, as innovations, etc. And as a result, if we were to return to Islam, if we were to begin to ascend the ladder of civilizational advancement and find that we need a legal philosophy, find that we need a framework which the legal philosophy provides to deal with unique questions of our era, we would have to do the same thing that Imam Shafi and Imam Ahmad and Imam Abu Hanifa did, but we're ill-equipped to do what they did. So as a result, major legal issues are being engaged without a meaningful framework and philosophy to understand them. And so what do we get? Every man is the judge and the jury and the Supreme Court, and unfortunately sometimes even the executioner. Because I think, based on my understanding, that we can do this. Or I think that we can't do this. And it's all opinion. And it's not informed opinion. It's uninformed opinion.
وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
This program has been sponsored by the Islamic Media Foundation, sharing the guidance of Allah through broadcast media and the internet.